brought to you by Burr and Foreman, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth Gordon and Lee Cantor.
Welcome to Results Matter Radio. I am Lee Cantor. I am without the beautiful Elizabeth Gordon. I am soloing here today, and we have an exciting show. On the show today, we have Chip Collins. He's an attorney at Burr & Foreman, and we have State Representative Wendell Willard, who represents the 49th District in the Georgia House of Representatives. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Now, today, we're discussing an important topic that is... It took a while to get through, but it's a topic, it's a statute that covers the non-compete agreements between employers and employees. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, Wendell, you want to talk about a little bit about just kind of the basics of this statute?
Happy to, Lee. I'll just give you some, I think, maybe a helpful history that we had to go through to get a law that would be, I guess you might say, legally enacted. Going back history-wise, you had the legislature in Georgia attempt to enact a law about 1989, the purpose of which was to give statutory provision as to what would be permissible and impermissible as far as employment contracts, because we did not have anything prior to that time in our statutes. And so what we had was just the courts, on whatever basis they felt it appropriate, to either recognize or disregard employment contracts with employment, and we felt that was not a workable way to do it. So the law was passed.
And when was this?
About 1989, as I recall. Then there was an early challenge to that law. I don't remember the name of the case, but it occurred about 1991. There was a challenge to the law, and the basis of the challenge was it being unconstitutional because Georgia has a very strong right to work provision in its law. And the court felt that without a appropriate constitutional change, the courts had to recognize the constitutional provision as far as right to work. So they said the statute as enacted then was inappropriate, unconstitutional, and struck the whole thing down. Well,
so now you're back to square one.
We're back to square one. We continued on from
then.
Well,
actually, you're back to before square one. Right, because now you got to deal with the Constitution.
Yeah, we have to now do what we can, but nothing was done for many years. So you go from 91 up until 2009 and 10, when the first really attempt was done by Kevin Levitas.
And I'll stop Wendell right there when he says nothing was done. Nothing was done by the legislature.
True.
But the Georgia Appellate Court, Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, we're then creating a law since we didn't have a statute.
Right.
And the untenable situation that took place was that the law was changing pretty much every time the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court issued a new statute.
So the court would issue a statute and that became...
I mean, a new opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
So that opinion became kind of king of the hill. That's the new rule until it changes again.
That's right. So all the lawyers would look at, you know, the case from 1995 and draft a non-compete using that case
right,
and think they had a good agreement until the next case came out, and all of a sudden you've got a whole slew of agreements that are unenforceable.
So it became very convoluted because of the court decisions, and you had a multitude of them, and trying to find what would be the way to draw a contract to address its enforceability. So I think lawyers had a lot of problem with that. Businesses had a lot of problems with it. And sorry to say about Kevin Levitas, who was in the House back in 2009 and 10, came forward first with the idea of having this amendment and to the Constitution as well as drafting legislation. One of the things we try to do when we are going to change the Constitution for the purpose of particular legislation, we will try to enact the legislation at the same time so people can say, okay, if we adopt this Constitution amendment, this is what will be the legislation that becomes enforceable under that language. So there was a House bill, I think it was 173, as I recall at that time, passed, and there was a what we call resolution, House Resolution 178, which was a constitutional provision. And they came forward. The act was passed in 2010. The constitutional amendment was approved. It went on the ballot in the general election in 2010, and it passed. You think, well, good, that's the end of it. We got the whole thing worked. And lo and behold, one of the people that brought to my attention was Chip Collins. I chair the House Judiciary Committee, and this is where the legislation came through. And we had a glitch. The glitch was that the provision of the Constitution had a no enactment date. The language just said, pass this. And the other provision of the Constitution says when you pass an amendment to the Constitution, if it doesn't speak of an effective date, it will then become effective on January 1, the date following the approval by the voters. So it was on the ballot in November 2010. That meant it came effective January 1, 2011.
Right.
Going back, this is where it gets a little change of problem. But going back, looking at the legislation says, oh, boy, if we pass this bill, we want it to be effective as soon as the constitutional amendment passes. So they were saying in the act that on the passage of the amendment, which was in November general election, this new enactment statute would be effective immediately.
Right.
Problem was the courts have recognized through other past legislation that you cannot have legislation become enacted without supporting constitutional provision. So even though we passed the constitutional provision, it was not effective until January 1. So we had to come to a realization that the act that we passed, having become effective on November 3rd by the approval of the voters, was in fact a void act.
And in Wendell's defense, every non-compete lawyer in Atlanta was following this statute,
right,
reading the bills and everything else, and they had their counsel down at the House look at these, and
nobody
caught this,
right,
until after the fact. And I was actually trading emails with another lawyer trying to figure out, you know, how has the world changed now. And we started talking about this one issue, and then we got somebody else involved and realized that, yeah, there might be a bit of a problem. And the last thing they wanted to do was create a statute that created more uncertainty and more problems. So that's when I got on the phone to Wendell, and he looked at it and said, yeah, you're right, I think we have an issue. But he jumped right back on it, and he can tell you about how he passed the new statute
so
the next year.
You had to create a new bill, or did you have to do a whole new constitutional amendment?
No, we just had to do a new bill, Lee, but we did that that year, 2011, with the beginning of the session. In fact, before the session started, I had drafted up the legislation, which became House Bill 30. I wanted it out there for everybody to see, recognizing we're doing exactly the same thing that we had done in 2010. It's just now the bill would be statutorily effective upon its passage and signing by the governor. So House Bill 30, went through the House and the Senate, was signed by the governor, and became effective, I think, upon the signature of the governor, as I recall the language. So it was actually effective about sometime early May of 2010.
That's right, May 11, 2011.
Yeah,
and what?
So just what, 12 short years after the initial effort to get this thing going?
Try 21 years.
20 years.
20 years. And, but what I thought was interesting, and I just learned it from Wendell out in the hall, was you know, we thought it would just be a matter of repassing the same statute.
Right.
But Wendell can tell you that it was almost a little more difficult,
yeah,
getting the statute through the second time. Some folks down at the House woke up and
actually
read the bill.
We had some members of the House who were in a employment situation that addressed such things as like an insurance agent who worked for a captive company, we call it. And he had gone through, I guess, some battles, and he became very vociferous about not wanting this bill passed. So I had to battle him, plus a couple of other individuals who had some opposition to it. So I was telling Chip the bill took on more opposition the second time around than the first time. But we got it through.
Now, historically, prior to this new bill, it was very employee-friendly. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now it was more employer-friendly?
Yeah, prior to the statute, when you were just dealing with the hodgepodge of case law that, like I said, changed with every
opinion. At the whim of who was the judge.
Not necessarily at the whim. These are judges trying to get it right, but they would notice yet another reason why these things could be. Wendell's been practicing law a lot longer than I have. But at any rate, it was very employee friendly, and only because there was almost impossible to draft an enforceable non-compete. And as a litigator representing employers, I bet 90% of the time some employer would come to me and say, "Hey, I've got an employee that left. I want to enforce this non-compete." I'd look at the agreement and say, "No, you don't have a chance."
So you could tell at a glance.
I could tell at a glance most of the time, especially if they didn't, even without looking at it, if they told me that a lawyer outside of Georgia drafted it,
then
I'd say it's 100%. Because you just had to have known all the nuances of all the cases.
Right?
And so that changed overnight on May 11th when this was effective, and it went from being very employee-friendly to being very employer-friendly. And probably the biggest change under the old regime, if you had one word wrong in an agreement, if the court thought it was overbroad, it had no choice but to just throw the whole thing out. Now the courts have the ability under the statute to do what's called blue penciling, which means they can read it, and even if they say, okay, this is overbroad, you can't restrict this employee from the entire United States. Under the old rules, they'd have to say, and because you drafted it too broad, it's no good. Well, now they can amend it. The judge can and say, all right, but I'm going to blue pencil this. I'm going to amend it judicially to read that the employee is only restricted from, say, the state of Georgia or Fulton County. And that's a sea change, because now instead of 90% of them being unenforceable, and when I look at them, now if somebody comes in, anything is potentially enforceable because the judge has the ability to revise it if it's too broad.
Yeah. And what he's talking about, Lee, is a provision or principle we had in Georgia, and that is we were kind of considered a minority state. We were looked upon as being one of those places unfriendly to employers with regards to employment contracts. Yes, we were friendly to employees. Because of this blue pencil provision, there could not be a review of the contract by a court. And if there was something that said, okay, you got too much territory involved, we're going to limit it to a specific defined area, say Fulton County. Or say, okay, you went 3 years. That's really too long a time frame to limit the employment. We're going to drop that back to 2 years. We did not have that provision. And so without that provision, the contract either stood as a whole or it fell because
of all or nothing.
One word or something that had to be out of line. So that left us in a position of not being what we felt to be business friendly. And it affected us because a lot of companies would not bring into Georgia people who had certain information, trade secret information, example, because they didn't want to be living in Georgia, employed in Georgia, and then have the contracts of their employment scrutinized by Georgia courts.
Right.
So these people would just say, no, we're going to stay in California. We're going to stay in Washington State. We're going to stay in New York State, whatever it may be. We're not going to put those employees in Georgia because of these problems. And we thought there had to be something to open us up to be more business friendly.
So then the thing that precipitated the change was the people wanted industry to feel more protected so that they would create more jobs here? Is that a portion of that?
Yeah, and this really brought us in line with the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, Georgia had become known as the absolute hardest state to enforce a non-compete. Pretty much most of the rest of the country had this blue pencil laws.
Right, so we were one of the last.
One of the last. So this just, you know, this was not unbelievably different and progressive. This is just catching up.
Right. Now, what are the industries that are most affected by this?
Well, it's pretty much any company with more than one employee, for starters.
But is it but primarily lots of sales?
It's a sales force.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, it's the you want to protect the employees or protect against the employees who are out there having the day-to-day contact with the customers from moving next door to those same customers.
And then bringing those customers with the
exactly.
The new job.
Or as soon as they move, those customers are the first ones they call when they move. So any company with a large sales force, you get in the financial services business with brokerages, insurance brokerages,
right. What about lawyers?
Lawyers, you won't good believe point. It, Lee, but that's the one industry that you can't prohibit by non-compete.
Really?
And it's sort of like there's a bunch of lawyers like Wendell down there at the State House.
Well, we're considered, you know, when you hire a lawyer, you hire the individual. And you have a right to change that individual at any time as a client. So we recognize that lawyers are somewhat unique by what they do as a type of profession. And you as the client have the right to make the change any time. So you can't really control clients by having a non-compete provision.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, physicians have them all the time.
Right.
It's a very important part of a lot of physician partnerships.
And that was the biggest area of litigation for years and years was the doctor's clinics, where there'd be a breakup of a clinic or whatever, and then one doctor goes off and takes a group of patients, and they get into litigation. That's where so much, if you read the case law history-wise, it seemed like involving internal medicine, practitioners in – I'm trying to think of fields.
What about like the ones like in
anesthesiologists?
Right. What about like the ones that have like the physician groups that are part of a hospital and then they leave? Is that the same?
Yeah, it's the same thing. And you know, the whole idea is that the employer is often the one facilitating, the employees from building up these relationships,
right, exactly.
Using the employer's goodwill and the employer's money to wind and dine these people. Or establish themselves in the community. And so you don't want to just allow the employee to, as soon as he or she feels comfortable that they can go on their own or go out next door, that they jump. And you also see it in the financial services business because those companies pay a lot on the front end for books of business to transfer. And those people, it pays for them to move every 3 or 4 years. So the non-competes and the non-solicits, the tightrope that the employers are walking is they still need to be competitive. And you don't want to be the employer that has the most strict non-competes on the block, because then the hot employee out there is going to go somewhere else where they don't make them sign a non-compete.
Right.
Or a less stringent, strict non-compete.
Yeah. We try to draft the legislation to really address what we call people who are in a specialized field or the executive level as far as ability to have restrictive employment contracts, as opposed to what we call the person who's like the snap-on tool route man, somebody who does route work. We did not want to have those people restricted by an employment contract because they don't really have a specialized trade. They may have a clientele that they work with on a regular basis, but we're trying to say no. People who have, for instance, trade secret information that's important to the employer, base of the clientele business-wise, that is the type of thing we were really looking to address and trying to be sure the contracts didn't get too broadly applied.
And that is a change from the existing law. So while they made it more easy to get these enforceable, these being non-competes, they also limited the types of employees that can be subject to these. And those are delineated. Directors, officers, managers, supervisors, anybody that has specialized skills or a lot of customer contact.
Now, so are there any other changes? Like what are the kind of – you mentioned those as some of the changes. Is there any other?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's several. For one thing, they've outlined – you know, so that you don't have to guess at what's enforceable. They said, okay, these are the provisions that will be deemed, they'll get the benefit of the doubt as far as enforceability. And so they've delineated and typically these things have to be reasonable as to three categories, time, duration, and generally 2 years under the statute, you know.
So
For 2 years or less. After the employee leaves, he or she could be restricted. They've got to be reasonable as to the geographic area.
Right.
Yep, and that's delineated in here. And then the scope of prohibited activities. It has to be you can't prevent an accountant from going out and doing sales, for instance.
Right.
So it has to be limited to the types of activities the employee was doing for the former
employer. But the judge, while looking at that, can then if they agree to a portion of it, like maybe they agree on the geography, but they can say, you know what, the geography is fine, but instead of 2 years, I only want it to be a year.
That's exactly right. But the one caveat and why we as lawyers cannot just draft these things that are just so onerous, knowing that the judge will fix it,
right,
is that the judge is not required to blue pencil. The judge may blue pencil. So if the judge thinks that the employer was really overreaching, there's no guarantee. The judge just may, sorry, I'm not doing your job for you, Mr. Lawyer, and this is overbroad and completely. Absolutely. So that's still a possibility.
Right.
However, the only opinion I've seen so far, the first opinion applying the new statute, the judge did blue pencil one down. Now, an important point to remember, and I can't remember if we talked about it or not, but right now you've currently got two sets of laws applying to non-competes, because the new statute only applies to non-compete agreements signed after the effective date, May 11, 2011. So if we were litigating over a 2009 non-compete agreement, it would still be under the old employee-friendly rules. So for any employers out there listening, if you haven't had your existing employees sign new non-compete agreements after May 11, 2011, you really, really need to do that to take advantage of the new statute.
Now, is that something that employers should be doing on a regular basis, is updating that? Or they typically, they did it one time when they hired the person and they kind of put it in a file and forgot about it?
Under the old rules, we'd say yes, because the law was changing from year to year. So let your attorneys audit it. Under the statute that Wendell and his colleagues gave us, that does provide us now some certainty. And so long as this statute remains in place, then I think there's some comfort. They don't have to. And would you agree, Wendell?
Yeah, I do. And I think the greatest example that's applied is territory changes. You're going to have people in employment with a territory that gets changed from month to month, year to year. So you can't always anticipate that, but you can say, okay, Judge, we originally had the contract address where his current territory was, but today in sales, he's in a different territory, a different client base, and the judge can look at that and say, you're correct, and we'll have that new territory applied, and that's where the blue penciling.
Right, that would be a good example of where the blue pencil would make sense.
Right.
Yep.
Now, right now, so you're an employer, you haven't done anything, what do you recommend the employer do?
I recommend the employer, if you hadn't done anything since May 11, 2011, I recommend the employers call their lawyers and tell them I need a new non-compete statute drafted for my employees. First, just to get a new one signed after May 11, 2011, but second, to get their old forms revised so that they conform with the language that that the legislature gave us in this new statute.
Wendell, would you agree with that?
Totally. Can't add any more to that.
You can't add any more to that. So now, other than that advice, is there anything else that they should be aware of, like regarding trade secrets with their employees, or you think that this is?
Well, the good thing about and trade secrets and non-compete go hand in hand.
Right.
And that's why you always have law firms that have like ours that have a non-compete and trade secrets group, because they're all after protecting the same thing. Protecting customer relationships, protecting confidential information.
Right.
The good thing is we have a trade secret statute. So trade secrets is, while you'll see it referred in employment contracts, even without an employment contract, you've got the benefit of Georgia's trade secret statute. However, to take full benefit of the trade secret statute, you need an employment agreement that has a confidentiality agreement, a non-disclosure agreement in it, because the trade secret statute says to take advantage of this statute and protect your trade secrets, the employer has to show that they've made efforts to keep those secrets, to keep their secrets secret. And one way of showing that is say, look, we've signed all of our employees up to these confidentiality agreements, and we enforce them.
Now, you mentioned Burr and Foreman's. You as an attorney there, you now are in charge of that group, is that right?
Yeah, I'm the head of our non-compete and trade secrets group, and we focus on representing our clients in all sorts of issues that arise out of the things we've been talking about here today. And because this is such a fast-moving area of the law, and it's also one that's pretty interesting. A lot of the lawsuits get pretty juicy. So it's something that you got to keep up with from a legal perspective, but also it's entertaining to read about sometimes. So we've started a blog to keep our clients and the public and our colleagues in the law abreast of changes. And our blog is Byrne Forman's Non-Compete and Trade Secrets blog at noncompetetradesecretslaw.com. And there are some other non-compete and trade secret blogs out there, but what differentiates ours is we believe we're the only blog that focuses on the law, and this is all state law. Non-compete and trade secrets is state by state. We think we're the only one that focuses on the law in our southeastern footprint, which is law of Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida.
Now, what are some of the things that will be posted on the blog? Are you going to kind of share what some of the cases that have gone through?
Yeah, it'll be a mixture of things. And it's up and running right now, so you can go look at it. But it's anytime there's a new case, a new change in law, for instance, had we had a blog when Wendell's statute passed, that's something that we would have blogged about. But we do have some blog entries on there reminding people to take advantage of the statute. Whenever there's something interesting, newsworthy, and I get these news items every day dealing with non-compete and trade secrets, we'll let folks know about that. And then we'll mix in some just practical tips that employers can use to try and protect their secrets and their customer relationships, because those are very valuable to employers and businesses.
Now, Wendell, you mentioned early on that part of the rationale for changing the law was that you wanted to be more employer-friendly. Have you seen any evidence that that's been the case, that employers are more open to moving their businesses here?
We have. In fact, I can, off the top of my head, name if there have been some companies that, for instance, deal with scientific information.
Right.
We had the new company that's coming in toward Social Circle. That was one of the concerns they had. I've heard about, and I can't remember the name of the company, but they specialize in blood, plasma, and they were concerned as an issue before they moved to Georgia. What was the status of the law in Georgia on that point?
So it has impact already jobs. That's
yes, sir.
That's always encouraging. Now, before we let you guys go, we'd like to ask each of our guests to share a piece of advice or some tip regarding the topic that we covered during the show. Is there, Chip, we want to start with you, a piece of advice you would give an employer regarding this issue?
Yeah, my advice, and it's worth repeating, which is if you haven't had new non-compete signed since May of 2011, you need to do so.
And Wendell?
I would echo the same thing, that the law has changed so drastically that the ability to now come under the new law needs to be utilized by the employers. There has been major changes that would benefit pulling out the old contracts. If not, as Chip pointed out, you're really dealing with an area of the old law that is not as friendly to employers.
All right. Before I let you go, Chip, you have a website. You want to give your website of Burr and also
the
blog?
Sure. The firm's website is Burr, BURR.com, and the blog website is noncompetetradesecretslaw.com.
And Wendell, you have anything?
Nope. I'm just a poor old working lawyer.
If somebody wanted to get a hold of you as a state representative, what's the area you represent in the state?
I represent an area that is part of Sandy Springs and East Roswell and a section of Johns Creek.
And they can find Wendell on the House website
right.
as well.
Great. All right. This is Lee Cantor for Wendell Willard and Chip Collins. We'll see you next time.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Forman and Business Radio X. Burr and Forman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Forman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.